This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 75. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this week, Mike?
So I have a little interesting tidbit to share. I launched a new product yesterday. Coincidentally, I started it yesterday too.
You built and launched a product in a day after working on your previous product for 3 years.
Yep.
So do tell.
It's more of an information product than anything else. It essentially, a lot of the consulting that I do is around the Altiris software line of products. And it turns out that for whatever reason, altiristraining.com was not taken as a domain name. So, and I know that I may very well run into issues later on down the road, but it does get some... It's, I'd say, relatively low searches, like 250 or 300 a month, but it does look like the competition is not very good. So even without altiristraining.com, I could still probably rank pretty well for it. It's basically a membership website. I think I briefly mentioned it last week. I threw the whole thing together in about 4 hours from beginning to end, and the site's up and running. The only thing that I have to do is record the screencasts and have them edited and post them up to the website. But other than that, everything looks like it's ready to go.
Swank. And how are you going to find customers?
So I've already discussed it with the company that I do consulting through, and they've said that, you know, they don't have a problem with me doing it, and, you know, they'd be happy to resell it and cross-sell it with some of the workshops that they're doing. So basically, my product will promote theirs. They're going to kind of bundle some of, you know, my offering in with their workshop so that people kind of get a better deal and then get on a trial version of this training software that I have. And then just we'll basically do some sort of a revenue sharing deal there. Other than that, it'll be online SEO, but there's a lot of old customers that I can go to that you always run out of time when doing these types of consulting engagements. They always wish that there was somebody there to do a little bit more handholding even after you leave. And this is a perfect way to do that.
Right. And the nice part is it's a high price point. So it actually can be fairly high touch sales if you need it to be.
And I already ran it by like the company that I'm currently working for. I said, is this something you'd be interested in? And he said, yeah, absolutely. And I asked him about the price, and he said that seemed fine. I said, well, what would be the process? He's like, I'd just go over and talk to so-and-so, and we'd get the corporate credit card, and we'd just pay for it. And I was like, that is just perfect.
I just got back from a 2-day personal retreat. I went to the coast. I try to do this every year, although it typically doesn't happen. It happens like once every 18 months. But my wife did it over the holiday, the Christmas holiday, and I finally decided to do it now, 1 month ahead of MicroConf, just to kind of get centered and do some thinking. And I tried to unplug. I did wind up checking email once, but the goal of these things is to not check email. And it's actually to not get on electronic devices at all. I just had some paper printed out. I had notes I was thinking about. I had a pen and paper. And so I did, I mean, I listened to a lot of music. I just did a lot of thinking, and I don't tend to do that. I mean, day to day with the wife and the kids and work and everything, I'm so product and like task driven, right? I think most of us are. It's like get through the email queue. Then, you know, you can jump into Twitter and do something. And then the kids get home and you have to make them dinner and get them to bed. And then you have time in the evening. And it's like, if you have energy, you know, you sit in front of the computer and you do more tasks. But like, how often do you just sit for 3 hours in a coffee shop and just think? And think with a plan. It's not like I was philosophizing. I mean, I was looking at what I'm going to be doing for the next 12 to 18 months and what I want to do with my businesses, how I'm going to do that. I had several revelations about how I'm going to approach some problems that have kind of been creeping up over the past several months. And some creative solutions came about that never come when I don't have time to think about it. It was good. And when I got back here, I talked to my wife about it. And I said, you know, I think I want to do that like twice a year now. She was saying, yeah, that she wants to do it in summer as well. So, you know, Mike, you had said you'd never done this. It's really quite fascinating. It's a really cool experience. And not only that, I feel like it was genuinely productive and that I'm going to be able to kind of move things forward at a faster pace by being more effective. Obviously, I lost 2 days of productivity, but I think I'll just more than make up for that in the next couple of months as I implement these things that I came up with during the time.
Like you said, I mean, I've never done that myself before, but I wouldn't rule it out as a possibility for me either. I mean, I've actually been thinking this week a lot because I've got an hour each way to drive for the current consulting customer that I'm working with. So I've been doing a lot of listening to our old podcast episodes, and question has come to mind for me over the past 2 years or so. I've been doing better and better each year. And this year, I'm wondering how I'm going to do better than last year, because it seems like there's a lot of, not necessarily roadblocks, but things that are in some ways holding me back from kind of getting a breakthrough or taking things to the next level and really moving forward with some of the things that I'm working on. And I just don't have a good way to do that, because I don't think that like an hour is to just think about that stuff is going to do it for me. I really think it's going to take a little bit more time. And what you said about cutting off email and electronics and everything else is probably something that I would kind of need to do in order to come up with those creative solutions in order to make those breakthroughs.
Totally. The thing I've learned from doing it is, one, when I go out there, I typically have two or three high-level questions that I want answered. So there's definitely some things that I want to seek solutions for. The other thing is, the first at least 2 or 3 hours that I'm driving, because it's a 3-hour drive, I had no music and I had no audiobooks. It was pure silence. And that's to kind of get all the noise out of my head, because there was so much noise. There's so much noise in our daily lives, you know? And it's like you almost have to decompress and get out of the mindset of the day-to-day first. And then that's when the actual creativity or some deep thought can start happening. And then I did that for a day. Not having the wife and kids was helpful for that. And then I got up on Tuesday morning and I had a podcast interview, and I had to get back into all the thought of things. And I did the interview, and then I needed another 2 to 3 hours to decompress and get back to the state. You know, one interruption that gets you back into like checking email or something really can throw you off for several hours.
Still working on a lot of MicroConf stuff and trying to finalize all the sponsorship things. I've got the USB drives ordered. They look absolutely awesome. I sent you a copy of what they look like. Then I've got the lanyards and the name badges and everything else all ordered. So that'll be arriving soon. And then I'll have to box it all up or get it ready and then box it up and ship it out to the hotel, make sure it's there on time. And that's pretty much it, though.
Cool. Yeah, things are coming together on my end as well. A lot of last-minute details wrapping up here. We got about a month, so it feels good. So I have two other things. One is on Twitter, there's a guy named Niche Site Guy, and he's starting a micropreneur mastermind in Sydney, Australia, if anyone is interested. He had tweeted both of us, and I just thought we should mention it. And then the other thing is I have 4 tickets to the sold-out Brighton SEO conference. It's April 13th, so it's by the time this goes live, it'll only be a little more than a week away. But they had 1,000. They have 1,000 attendees, and it sold out in like 20 minutes because they give the tickets away for free, and then sponsors get some tickets as well. So if anyone wants one of those, you can probably best is to reach me via email through my blog. Just go to my blog about page and you can email me through there.
So we're going to be going through a bunch of listener questions. They're starting to stack up again. Some people we've emailed back already, but I think that it's good for people to hear all of the questions that are coming in. So the first question is from Casey Stein. He says, "Hi guys, I'm a big fan of your show and an aspiring micropreneur. I've been struggling to come up with an idea I can get excited about until just recently. I was hoping if I quickly outlined it here, you guys might let me know what you think and if it has potential. The basic idea is a site where local merchants can go and list all their clearance items. Local customers could then either browse what's on clearance at a bunch of stores or search for certain things. The revenue model could be free for customers and maybe $99 a month for the business owner to list as much as they would like to list. I feel like this would be a great way for local businesses to get rid of all their excess stuff and for customers to find great deals. Thanks in advance for your advice, Casey."
So I guess I'll say first, evaluating business ideas is always tough because it's like you and I can sit here and say our opinion, but frankly, if someone had brought Facebook to me in 2003, I would have said it's a terrible idea. So from my perspective, I have thoughts on this. No one should take what Mike and I say as obviously as like the end all be all of thoughts on it. So I think my big concerns with this idea are that it's a two-sided market and that you basically need to go to stores and charge them $100 a month. And then you also need to get local customers to go and browse. And so that's a really hard problem to do, right? It's like you have to now market to two separate audiences. So how are you going to get all those people? I mean, I guess, are you going to cold call stores you're going to have an audience first, right? You're going to have to say, I have 1,000 viewers a month, or else why are they going to pay you $99 a month? I guess you could start off and say, all right, it's free for now until we get a big audience, and then go out and try to build a big audience. But what? How are you going to get an audience of local people? So that's my big concern. This is not a trivial, you know, easily attainable idea. Unless you see, do you see a kind of a marketing approach that I'm missing on this one?
I really think that you could probably go the route of like local Facebook ad listings or local Google listings. I mean, Craigslist would be good. I got an email from Google several weeks ago asking if I wanted to advertise on, I think it was like Search Local or something like that for Google. But basically, it was for local businesses to get noticed by people online. So I think there's a few different ways to do it, but I totally agree with you that because it's a two-sided market, you're going to have problems, and I don't think that it's something you could charge for up front, just because if, you know, without traffic, who's going to pay for, you know, you to send these out? So leveraging Facebook, leveraging social networks is probably the way to go, and I would probably start very small, starting definitely in your local area, so that then you could go directly talk to local business owners who would have the say-so or would want to be able to do that.
Because the face-to-face will be a big deal for getting those initial guys in there, right? Saying you're the local boy. So that does mean that you probably need to live in an area that's populated enough that you, I mean, it'd be great if you lived in a larger city. Because if you are going to go local, that's the struggle. If you live in a small town, you're just not going to have enough revenue. You're not going to have enough businesses that are interested.
Right. I think the other problem or challenge would be convincing like the larger stores to get on board. So, you know, like here there's a Best Buy, for example, near me. How would I go about convincing Best Buy to list some of their clearance items? I guess if they're clearance items, it's not like they're giving them away.
Right. But then it's manpower, right? It's like they need to take a digital photo of it, and they need to list it on your site, and they need to do that. And if they're going to do that, why wouldn't they list it on, say, eBay or on Craigslist? Unless you have a big audience and they can get a little more for it, or they can sell it faster. It's kind of an interesting, it's like local merchants can do stuff. I'm trying to get my head around really what this serves. Like, are there people out there saying, I mean, I never think to myself, what are the cheap things available here in Fresno? I've never thought that to myself, but are there people who would do that? And I guess if they do that, do they ship the item? Does Best Buy then ship the item, or they just reserve it for the person to come pick up? I wonder how that fulfillment would work.
I would think that the person would just go to whoever the local merchant is and just pick it up. I can't see it being more like an eBay, especially for like the larger stores. It's going to be very difficult for them to pipeline things so that it's a lot more hands-off, so they can just say, oh, well, we've got these 25 items that we're discontinuing. We don't want to ship them back to the warehouse or try to send them through whatever liquidation process that they probably already have in place. But the smaller merchants probably have things on their shelves that they just want to get rid of, or they want to get out of there because it's taking up valuable floor space that they could use to sell something that actually does move. So There's that whole logistical problem that you have to deal with the local merchants, because they've got floor space that they've got to deal with that's valuable to them. And if you've got this stuff that's just sucking up space, they could potentially use that for other things. I mean, heck, they could use it for advertising space for all I know. I mean, maybe that's more effective. It sounds to me like there's probably something to do here. I would definitely go talk to some local merchants and say, is this a service you would be interested in using? And I don't even know if I would push for a price. I would just say, is this something you would use?
I would ask, and if they pay for it on a monthly basis. If I was a local merchant, I would, if I'm going to go to the trouble of taking a photo of something and listing it somewhere, I would want to get the largest audience possible, and I would post it on eBay or maybe Craigslist. But if it was too big to go on eBay and it can't ship, I'd post it on eBay or Amazon. If it was too big, then I would go probably to Craigslist, which is going to have way more local people than you're going to be able to bring.
Yeah, I think somehow you'd have to make it easy for people to upload those things. I mean, because the merchants are not going to want to have to spend a lot of time with that. And I don't know if photos are the way to go. If you can drive people to the store, or, you know, drive physical traffic to the store because somebody saw something on clearance and says, oh, we've got these 25 things that are on clearance over at Joe's Shack of Stuff, and you get 10 or 15 people to go into the store to actually physically look at the things because they couldn't view them on the website, then those are 15 people that the store would not have gotten in the door to begin with that may very well buy other things.
Right. So it does seem like a problem of how to find the consumers then. How are you going to get them to your site? Even if you post on Craigslist and do some marketing there, you know, how are you going to get people to come back?
Yeah, so I think
it's an interesting idea.
I think that's a mailing list issue.
Yeah, right. It's kind of a Groupon thing where you build up the mailing list and you post the new deals of the day.
Mm-hmm. Post all the new clearance stuff. But yeah, interesting idea. I I would hesitate to say whether it would fly or not, but
yeah, it's going to take quite a bit of work. I'm lukewarm about it, but definitely, I mean, I see there's some potential here.
Yeah, for the right I do person. Too. So our next question is from Travis. And Travis's question asks, is this a feasible development / outsourcing plan? And he says, I just finished Start Small, Stay Small, and you convinced me to give outsourcing development a second look. I'm wondering if a feasible outsourcing plan would be to hire an expensive PHP consultant or developer to turn my basic outline or concept into a detailed spec and then use that as the basis for outsourcing to a cheaper overseas developer, possibly using an expensive developer as a QA check along the way and or at the end. I have the cash required to do this, assuming that it's $3,000 to $7,000. Do you think this is a good and viable plan to outsource development? FYI, today I listened to your recent podcast episodes on managing remote developers and VAs and thought they were very helpful. Thanks and looking forward to your insights, Travis. So I think that my take on this would be no. I don't know as that's going to help you unless you have a very, very good relationship with that senior developer and you're able to have discussions with them personally. And if you know them and they're able to spend a lot more time with you to fully understand what it is that you're trying to accomplish, I think then that case it can work. But I think that if you're just hiring somebody who you don't know and who you don't have that personal relationship with and that they're, you know, overseas or across the country or something along those lines, I think that's going to be much more difficult because they're not going to fully understand exactly what it is that you're looking for. I just don't think that you're going to be able to convey that very well, especially since you're not a programmer. I think if you were a developer, it would probably be a little bit easier, but I still think that it's tough to outsource your vision. It's something that I don't think that has ever worked in the past. I mean, maybe there's some, you know, rare exception somewhere, but I think that generally speaking, if you're trying to outsource your vision to somebody else to kind of build that detailed spec, I think it's going to be difficult.
Yeah, I question the value of trying to do that. The more people you get involved in any project, the more potential you have for things to slip through the cracks and for miscommunication and all that. And I'm not sure why exactly you'd want to hire kind of an expensive developer. I think you're going to be better off communicating your vision, like Mike said, if you get a mock-up tool like Balsamiq and create basically your visual spec. You create a functional spec. It's not a detailed technical spec. You don't say all the database tables and all that stuff. You leave that up to a developer. Because I think as soon as you get an expensive developer involved, let's say you hire someone for, you know, $75 or $100, you're going to spend a ton of time communicating to them. And it's going to be, you know, fairly expensive. And then they're going to write up this detailed spec. But they are going to leave a few things out here and there. They're not going to manage that other developer for you. You're then going to have to take that, communicate it to the other developer, the cheaper developer, and you're going to have to manage them. But you don't even really know what they're building. So how can you manage them very well? I mean, I guess you're saying you would hire the expensive guy to then come back and double check that they're doing the right thing. But by that time, I mean, you're paying a heck of a lot of money now to have basically two people kind of doing quasi-duplicate work. So I've never seen anyone do this successfully. It's not something I would try. Back when I was developing, I would not have taken a project like this on. I would have been considered the higher priced developer. And there's just, to me, this would just be a big headache. This is all the parts of development that I do not like, right? I want to be the guy writing the code. I don't want to be the guy communicating requirements into specs and then handing them off to a cheaper developer. So I don't know if you could even find someone, you know, who'd be willing to do this, but I don't know. It's a creative approach. I've never heard anyone do this.
I think the other issue is that if you're hiring a expensive person and then you're going to turn it over to an overseas developer, that overseas developer is going to be significantly cheaper. Let's say it's $15 an hour and your local developer, let's say he's $60 an hour. Then you're essentially having this person who you're paying $60 an hour, who is arguably equivalent to this $15 an hour developer overseas, build specs for somebody who is more or less that person's peer. And I don't know, is that buys you anything? I mean, why even bother bringing in that other person? Because as Rob said, introducing more people just introduces more complexity and more situations where somebody can misinterpret something. And if you misinterpret something to the higher cost developer, then he's going to turn around and miscommunicate it to the lower cost developer. And now you've got two people who are both thinking just the wrong thing. So thanks for the question, Travis. I think that both of Rob and I are in agreement that we would not go down this particular road. So our next question is from Mark Voyer. and he says, "Hi guys, as a suggestion for a podcast or just a Q&A podcast, could you talk about what to do when you feel like you're losing interest in the project you've been building for months, if not years? In my case, I've been building this application for years. Its first version was in ASP.NET, then rewrote it in Silverlight, and now it's in HTML5 and JavaScript. It's been 3 to 4 years in development, mostly part-time, and even though it's near a 1.0 version, which is actually a trimmed-down version, so I don't have many more months of development and debugging, I'm lacking the energy and desire to put in the final hours. So is it better to put it away for some time to recharge and maybe never get back to it, or take a last sprint to finish it? This could represent 4 to 6 weeks of full-time effort. If I put it out there, I'm not even sure I'll have the energy or desire for the support and marketing. Of course, I shouldn't be in this situation, having worked for so long without really showing it to clients and customers, but as developers building their own stuff, we often know that it's like that. Thanks so much for the podcast, and thanks for your honesty. Mark."
So I think both you and I have a lot to say about this stuff.
Yeah.
So I have the two ideas that pop in right off the top of my head are, the first thing I think you need to do is get a reality check. And that's just to look at the project, look at yourself and say, is this something that I really want to do? Is this something that's viable? Knowing what you know now, you know, if you've listened to our podcast or other podcasts, or you just have an idea of how you're going to market this thing, is it even viable, or is it something that you shouldn't finish at all? Just because you've sunk costs into it does not mean that you should continue. So that's the first thing. And if you can stand back and take a reality check just yourself, that's great. If you need to ask a friend or a colleague or a trusted advisor, then do that. The second thing I would recommend, frankly, I was feeling pretty frustrated with Hittail, you know, a month ago. And it had a little dip, and I've been working on it for 6.5 months now. It's acquired it almost 7 months ago. And one of the reasons I wanted to go on this personal retreat was to say, where am I going with this and what needs to happen with it? And so I would suggest, if at all possible, Mark, that you try to take at least a day, and preferably an overnight, away from work and away from everything. I realize that may or may not be feasible for you, but it had a profound impact on the way I'm viewing Hittail, the way I'm viewing all my businesses, and some of the approaches I'm going to take over the next 12 months. So that totally cleared my head. And I think that, you know, it could potentially have the same for you. And my guess is you'll come out of it with a fire and a passion to finish this thing, or you'll come out of it and say, wow, this definitely should not be done. I made a mistake, and I'm going to start on my next idea that I'm really excited about.
So I think my take on it is in many ways similar to what you said. And the first question to ask is this even a viable product? I mean, because you have been working on it for a while, and I understand you haven't really shown it to customers or worked with customers, but is it something that they even want? And the other thing I question, which I guess doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the whole problem, is why was it rewritten 3 times? If you're really having problems with it and you feel like it definitely does have a market and that people would actually pay for it, if it's only 4 to 6 weeks of effort, I mean, you basically have two options. Either you can buckle down and get it done, or you can go out to Odesk or someplace like that and try to find somebody and outsource it to somebody to finish it. And that's a perfectly acceptable option. I mean, I know a lot of people say, well, especially developers, they're like, well, you know, I'm a developer, this is my core competence, I really want to be doing this, I should be doing this stuff. But if you find yourself at a point where you just are not motivated to do it, but you are sure that there's a market for that product, then I don't think that there's anything wrong with it. I think it's more of a mental hurdle that people have to get over, that is all the code that's in a particular product written by you? No. Well, does it matter that it was written by you? What matters is it a successful product? And there's a project that probably about 2 months ago had been sitting on my hard drive for, I don't know, at least 1.5, 2 years. And it's something that I just hadn't come back to because I didn't really have any motivation to do it. And I said, you know what? Why am I even considering working on this? Because I'm just not motivated to do it. But the reason I was thinking that was because I know that it would make money if I were to finish it. So I actually hired somebody to finish it for me. And there's another project that's been sitting around for a while that I know has viability and that people would pay for it. And I'm outsourcing that as well. So you can get things done without actually having to do that. And what it will allow you to do is it will allow you to back off from the development and start focusing on the marketing. And while you're doing the marketing for it, you can help determine whether it really, really is viable. And if it's not, in 3 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever, if you've sunk a bunch of money into it and paying somebody to finish it, and you really do find out that it is no longer viable at that point, well, then you kill it.
Yeah, I think the thing that both of us said, and you said it several times, is assuming this has, if you're sure this has a viable market. And so I really do think that's the first step, right? It's like, go talk to customers. don't write another line of code. You've rewritten this thing three times. It's been 3 to 4 years. Go talk to customers. Step number one, bottom line. Like you have to figure out if people are willing to buy it. You need to figure out how long the sales cycle is going to be. Are you going to be willing to do high touch in-person sales if that's what this requires? If you're selling to enterprises and large financial institutions or whatever, we don't know what the product is, but really think about that if that's something you want to do. Because if you don't, then you should just shut this down now. But if it does have, some other avenues you can do more online marketing and you're interested in doing and learning online marketing, then do this. But if you're not, honestly, if you've built this product and you're not interested in kind of learning the marketing and, getting better at that, driving traffic and doing that kind of stuff, then it's not something that you should be attacking at all, frankly. I don't think you should try to launch a product if you're not willing to learn marketing and really take it head on.
So that's our take on it, Mark. Thanks for the question and good luck. Let us know how things turn out for you. So our next question comes from Chris. He says, "Hi, first off, I love your show. It has really geared me to take steps in setting up my business model and prepare myself for a journey I'm just getting ready to begin. I basically have a product that I have resources and connections to make and ultimately have what I need in place in order to do small beta testing to get a read on numbers, but most importantly involve getting a patent. I would love to hear your experiences with patents in the past, and I assume your software and such is proprietary, and you would have taken these steps at some point. Any input as far as time investment, when it is time to get one, etc., would be of great value to me, and I really value your opinion. Thanks so much, Chris." And I actually emailed him back and forth with him a couple of times just to find out whether it was a software product, and he came back and said it's not a software product, it's a line of aesthetically designed children's wear. He said that the concept around that really needs to be protected, especially given, the specifics of it, because it is a physical good. So I basically told him that we don't necessarily do a whole lot of physical goods patents. Rob, have you ever dealt with software patents in the past?
So I have not with physical stuff. I did acquire an in-progress patent application when I bought Hittail. That was part of it. They had a patent filed and I shut it down. Like I abandoned it. So I don't know if this will apply to Chris's question, but this whole software patent thing has just gotten out of control. It's ridiculous. You're not supposed to be able to patent ideas, and yet people are patenting ideas with software because the patent people don't understand software. So I actually vehemently disagree with the ability to patent what we have allowed people to patent in the U.S. In 1998, I think it was, the patent law used to only be able to copyright software and not patent it. And then in 1998, that changed. And since then, it has had a major detriment on our industry. And now there are people, Google spent billions of dollars just to acquire a company for patents. So there's this money that could really go into innovation and actually helping create new jobs and such. And it's going into fighting these legal battles. So for software patents themselves, I almost across the board have a pretty negative reaction to them. So that's one thing. So that was instantly on my mind when I got Hittail of like, do I really want to do this? Do I really want to try to patent something? Am I going to go sue someone if they develop the same grid that shows keywords? Because that's what it was for, right? It was for like the display of keywords based on certain things, which to me, that's the problem with software patents is everyone I hear about is an obvious patent. I did let it expire. I also let it expire because I had a conversation with a few guys. It was, Ted and Harry at Business of Software actually said, why do I care if it's patented? I just care if it works. Because I was going to patent the algorithm, right? It didn't matter to them. That was another step. And then finally, patenting the actual algorithm of Hittail wouldn't have been very smart because you have to reveal the formula. It's the same reason that Coca-Cola has never patented their formula. It's in its public record. So.
Right. And Coke treats the formula for that as a, I think it's called a trade secret.
Trade secret.
Yeah. Which is a little different than a patent.
That's right. Yeah. And that's what someone actually told me, that I could treat, the Hittail algorithm as a trade secret. So.
Yeah.
So yeah, but no experience with physical patents.
I know two different people, both relatives of mine, who have patents. My uncle has a patent. He's a taxidermist, or was a taxidermist, ran a taxidermy for a long time. And he actually created a patent for, molding fish heads out of some synthetic material, because you can't dry out a fish head and mount it on a fish because it basically just looks terrible. So basically he created a system where you could create a molded fish head. And then my grandfather has a couple of patents, one one for, and this is a little bizarre, it was basically for skinning animals and then something else for delivering newspapers. But those are all for physical goods. I mean, that's kind of what patents were originally intended for. So I don't think that it's unwarranted to go after a patent for something, but there's also a very long and complicated process that you have to follow. You know, the one thing I would mention, though, is if you're interested in getting a patent, you want somebody to talk to about who actually knows it, because Rob and I obviously don't, you should go talk to the guys over at the Lifestyle Business Podcast. Both Dan and Ian have a lot more a solid grasp on that type of thing, because they deal with physical products all the time. That's what they do. They sell these physical products all over the place. So they may very well know about it, but at the same time, they may not, because they also deal outside of the U.S. So I don't know what international patent laws cover at that point. So that may be something they could help you out with. So the last question for today is from Brandon. He says, "Hi, Mike and Rob. Love your podcast. It was the first thing I started listening to when I started even considering to develop a software product. My question is this. I'm located in Canada and building an app which caters specifically to Canadians. Similar services exist already in the U.S. but cannot be used here. I spent hours trying to find a suitable .com domain to use for my application and name of the product and came up with one that I'm only about 60% happy with. Given that I'm catering to Canadians, I got to thinking that maybe I should ditch the .com and go with a different name and a .ca. There's obviously going to be a lot more choice in that way, not to mention the fact that it might help to emphasize the fact that this software is built in Canada. My only concern is that .com is always pushed as the beachfront internet real estate. How important is this? Your thoughts would be very much appreciated. Thanks, Brandon."
Basically, you pointed out if someone searches in google.com, then they're going to be more likely to get a .com. If they search in google.ca, then a .ca domain name is going to be more likely to rank higher. And Google actually looks at, you know, it's been said that they look at where your website is hosted. So if you're actually hosted in Canada, that you will tend to have a little bit better chance of ranking in, you know, a google.ca. Remember, there are over 100 factors that go in, 100 signals they use. So, you know, these could be dialed down pretty low. So you pointed out that, you know, if he really is only going after Canadians, then google.ca would probably be fine. And I'd agree with that. That assumes that there is going to be at least some search traffic for this. And I don't know whether there is or isn't, because we don't really know the software. But I would say going after google.ca is fine. The only hesitation I have is there is absolutely a bias towards .coms. People just know .com. It's the gold standard. It's the beachfront property, as you said. And I think if you have any inkling that you're ever going to expand outside of Canada, that trying to come to the US and sell something on a google.ca domain name will absolutely be a detriment to you. People do have biases against the country domain, the country-specific domain names. So I would definitely think about that if you ever plan to expand, I would think about going with a .com.
What you just said there was something I hadn't actually thought of, was that if he tries to expand outside of Canada, then it's going to totally blow apart any SEO that he was doing. So in that sense, if he's never going to expand outside of Canada for this, you know, service or product, then it's worth, I think, considering a .ca domain. But otherwise, I think that a .com would probably be better. And I don't know if your product name needs to match the company name. That was something that was kind of thrown in there that I know a lot of other people have kind of run into this in the past, where they start a company and then name the product after the company, and then they throw the product out there, and for whatever reason, they find out that the product doesn't fly, or it doesn't fit, or they just decide to shut it down for whatever reason, or pivot, and then they go after something else. Now they've got a company name that was geared for a specific product in a specific market, and it no longer matches whatever the new thing is that they're going after. So I'd be very careful about having those two things be the same. I think, Rob, you know, the company that you formed is called the Numa Group, which is very ambiguous. I mean, that could be just about anything.
I did that on purpose, and the Numa Group was my consulting firm for years. And then I just, as I started owning products, I just put them under the umbrella, and it transitioned into it's all product firm. You know, I don't do any consulting anymore. So I didn't put the name consulting or software or anything in it. I had an imagination that it could house a lot of things. And at one point I even considered like buying some real estate under it. I mean, it was just basically going to be an umbrella LLC to own different things. Whereas you formed two corporations and you put the same name, but software in one and consulting in the other, right?
Right.
Moon River Software, which is your product business, and then Moon River Consulting.
Yep. But that was primarily for legal reasons anyway.
Right. It was to separate it, because you tend to have more liability because you work with really large enterprises and have a lot of exposure.
Yeah. But back to this person, I really think it's a judgment call that you're going to have to make when you decide whether or not you're going to go after a .ca domain or not. And I think that there's some ways that you could probably do some quick testing to figure out whether or not a .ca or .com domain would be better. And I think that if you were to try and create, like both a .ca domain for something, and you could just buy like four or five different domains and test this out fairly inexpensively, but get hosting in Canada, get hosting in the US, and then register some domain name that means absolutely nothing that nobody would consider ranking for in either country. And it could be just something that completely nonsensical. And then, you know, make sure that those domains match in both Canada and in the US, and then build the sites. I mean, they could be identical sites other than the .com and the .ca domain behind it, and then test going to those sites or searching for them in Google from a server or a computer that's in Canada. Search for the same thing from a server or computer that's located in the US. I mean, you could do simple Windows hosting or something like that for a month or 2 months or something like that, and figure out whether or not, you know, what those results come back with in Google to see if it actually matters to you or not.
Make sure to use an incognito window in Google Chrome so that it doesn't jack with your results, by the way. Now that Scroogle.org got shut down by Google, that's kind of the
oh, they did
it these days. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sucks. Yeah, we'd been recommending him in the Academy for years. I had to go remove the link. Yeah, I think that's an interesting idea to do a parallel test. That's going to matter if SEO is going to be a substantial part of the business. I think another approach to think about is to talk to some potential customers and ask them if they even care, if they care if it's a .ca, if that means something to them, you know, if that will actually help your sales or hurt your sales. You know, ask them if you had this.com and this.ca, what it would matter to them. I realize that it seems kind of odd to ask a potential customer that, but they're going to know more than, you know, than Mike and I about your potential market. I have certain predispositions to think of certain domains as being more valuable or just more legitimate than others, but that's mine, and I'm probably not going to be buying your product. So what really matters is what your customer thinks.
One thing that I find interesting is there's a lot of companies out there that will make plays on words with strange domain names. So like, for example, bit.ly, and basically play around with the country extensions. If you're doing something like that, I think that to people, it probably matters a lot less.
That's a good point. Yeah, that you can actually make a word out of it.
Yeah, Rob makes a really good point about the SEO and whether or not that makes a difference. So you got to take all those different things into account and figure out whether or not how people are going to find you, whether they're going to be linking back to your site, and whether it inspires confidence in your service or not. So if you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it in MP3 or text format to questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. So our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider writing a review in iTunes by searching for Startups. You can also subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of this podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.